Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays. You're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like? Because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora. He's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/Count the Dings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Tom, what is your favorite snack food when you're getting blitzed in your favorite bar?
Oh, this is easy. This is easy. Salsa and chips.
The answer is wasabi peas. This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, really solid. Episode number 2 of season 21, Top Chef Wisconsin. We had challenges that capture the spirit of the location. We had the elevation of lowbrow food, which I think is always a good time. We had friend of PYK, Joe Flam, driving up I-94, or probably more likely getting a town car from the good people at Bravo, to go up I-94 from Chicago to Milwaukee to serve it as a guest judge for the entirety of the episode, Tom, which is like in the hierarchy of honors. Like sometimes people pop in just for the quick fire or just, you know, kind of sit for the elimination. Like Flam got the whole, he got the whole hog, man.
He did, because he's the Flambino. He is the great Flambino. He's the guy that came back to win the very first Last Chance Kitchen and reminded Kristen of that honor. He's great, great personality. I want to know, We're hopefully going to talk to Joe Flam here for Pack Your Knives in the not too distant future. And I want to know, did he even want the Top Chef hosting gig? Because he'd be good at it. He certainly has the personality, but he's running Rosemary in Chicago, a wonderful restaurant. I haven't had the chance to go there yet.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard it's just incredible.
It's a great experience. Maybe we'll have to, I'll have to conjure my memories to do, for the Pack Your Knives Substack. I will maybe have to do a retro review of my beautiful meal there.
I noticed that too, Kevin. This episode didn't just have a guest judge on the Quickfire. He held over and got that prestigious honor of being able to do the entire episode. And what an episode it was for him to do like the Miller challenge. It felt like a very Joe Flam episode to go to the Miller Brewery and go to the cave, the old historic cave that they, I guess they steep the hops or steep the brew that makes Miller High Life as delicious as it is. But also the Quickfire with hops was really fun because it's not a traditional, it's not something you see on a menu, and it's a really tricky ingredient that I think a lot of the chefs had a challenging experience trying to incorporate that. So there was a high degree of difficulty. And I just think that the chemistry between Joe and Kristen shined through in this episode. And I gotta say, like, through two episodes, Kristen's done a really great job again.
I love it. And I think already I'm seeing an identity emerge, which is she is at heart a food dork. And I mean this in the best possible way. You know, look, Padma can clearly cook and, but it's not her specifically her training, right? I mean, she wasn't a chef by trade, and Kristen is in a way that the Colicchio is. And it's clear just her knowledge, like the analysis on the fly. She is a fantastic, stylish, classy food dork. And that's starting to come in, I think, in the identity. And I love it because this is a food competition show. Hops is hard, Tom. Hops is really hard. And I think judging from the performances and the judges and the nature of hops, it seems like the herbaceous dessert is the smart way to go, that it carries such a bitterness, that kind of floral bitterness, that it's the only way to counteract that. And alternatively, maybe fusing it with fruit somehow, which we saw Michelle do, and she got on the top three of the Quick Buyer. You got to work off a sweetness of something to counter the bitterness of the hops, and that the successful chefs were able to do that. The unsuccessful chefs sort of, unfortunately, kind of weren't able to sort of counter or account for the bitterness. $5,000 was on the line, Tom, in the Quickfire, which is, again, the new format you've talked about. They're going to give money for the Quickfire. An elimination challenge will earn the victor immunity. So this is sort of the new structure. I'm kind of into it. And then we got the hops, right? These Quickfires, when you got like still 13, 14 contestants on the board, are kind of intense.
It is. And it's really challenging for magical elves or whoever's editing these episodes, because there are 14 dishes that they got to go through in the Quickfire, and you can't have responses or reviews for all of them. I noticed while I'm watching that when Dan presented his charred cabbage salad, they just cut to the next person, right? They were like, and here's my charred cabbage salad. And then, oh, but here comes Alicia. And they did the same thing for Manny, where he had his oven roasted pork loin and he puts it on the plate on the table. And then they just cut to the next person. Not even one little quip from the judges. They got to keep it moving. And that's where we are with the Quickfire in episode two, where it's just, you know, we got to get to the elimination challenge. And secondly, how about Laura coming right off the bat when we say she might be the Nikola Jokic of the draft, where a second round pick, the best player in the NBA, comes after, you know, 45 picks, then you get the best player of the generation. That's kind of Laura here, where she comes out with the rice pudding right away as one of the last picks of the draft. And if you haven't listened to it yet, go listen to the, for our premium subscribers right away. You can listen to the draft episode that we did for this year, which was super fun. Laura went, I think she went 14th.
She was the last of the remaining of the surviving surviving chef test, and she was the last pick. She was Mrs. Irrelevant in the parlance of the NFL, kind of the last pick of the draft. And I think what worked for her, kind of going back to the herbaceous dessert, is she and Kevin both did two things. First of all, they both did dessert, which again was the smart thing. But hops, I get the sense hops is kind of gross. But what you want to do is you want to infuse it. You don't want to serve it. Certainly don't want to serve it raw. It's hard to cook with. But if you infuse your rice in your rice pudding, if you infuse the milk and the cream, which is what she did, just as Kevin infused the oil that he used to roast the black fruit and the red fruit and possibly the crumble, right? Like those are probably the two highest rated dishes. And it was more of an infusion than a straight up use, right? Laura wins. They both do dessert. again, not a coincidence. The two chefs of the 14 that did dessert were probably the first and second finishers, right?
Did you feel like Kevin, when he said he was a big dessert guy, when before the quick fire started, they did a little like talking to Kevin, Kevin, did you feel like that was a good thing? Or were you like, oh, I don't want my person to be a pastry forward chef. You want someone who maybe more experienced, or I guess more geared towards entrees and main events rather than dessert. I actually thought that that was a good thing for Team Kevin, is that Kevin is really good at desserts. He proved it here.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk more about Kevin because he had an interesting week. I always love the chefs that finish on the top of the quick fire and the bottom of the elimination, or vice versa, right? Mm. Like, there's clearly a market inefficiency, Tom, in pastry, right? It terrifies half of the field. I mean, you have some of these great chefs who just pastry was never part of their game. The challenge does come up from time to time. You know, there's always an opportunity and a team challenge to do dessert. It's a great thing to have in your back pocket for the finale. For God's sakes, it's like a third or a fourth of your grade. Mm-hmm. So if you can win that title. So having pastry, and frankly, pastry can help you in savory competitions, right? It tends to bode well for pasta. It tends to, you can do various crusts, and there's chemistry that is required in baking that works in straight up cooking. But I think like it can work in your favor. Now, it actually, I think worked against them a little bit in the elimination. We'll talk about that later. But clearly the answer to the riddle, oh my God, how do I work with hops in a quickfire challenge, was clearly make dessert. Or if you're Michelle, incorporate it with a fruit forward vinaigrette or salad, right? Like, strawberry is so sweet. And she was able, with her grilled flank steak, which was, it looked like it was kind of rubbed with the hops, or a hops marinade, and then she had this charred strawberry shallot salad with a strawberry hops vinaigrette. So again, infusion, not straight up use, and sweet, not savory, I think was the course of the day. Those are the three chefs that were successful. It didn't look like there were a lot of other bangers in that group of 14 plates.
Yeah, and even if there was, I don't think they'd have time to show us. Charlie did the really spicy, with, you called it, some pickles right off the bat. You said, hey, we're probably going to get it. And we got it right on the next one on the quickfire. The very spicy fried chicken that caught Job by surprise. Oh, by the way, yeah, we used a very spicy Haitian relish there. And it doesn't strike me as Joe Flam is a very, he's not going on hot ones and dominating that competition. So yeah, not too much notables other than the winners in the bottom. You know, Valentin didn't do well in this one with the duck. He didn't render it enough. And so it didn't nail there. Kenny continued. I was just like, man, he undercooked the Pharaoh. This guy's going out. He's two in a row where he's just fumbled on the cook. And it seemed like he was going in a south direction. But as we learn, elimination challenge was a whole new event. So the people who were up in the quickfire didn't necessarily predict. Momentum is not a thing in Top Chef, Kevin. And I think we're going to see an elimination challenge. This gets a lot spicier.
Yeah, I mean, Kenny is another red flag, because if you undercook your Pharaoh, that's a time issue, right? Why is something undercooked? You ran out of time. And so that would be the concern I'd have, as, and he is a member of team Kenny. So maybe, you know, we'll the development coaches will get out on the floor with him, work a little bit on time, you know, put up a clock or something, because that is sort of, he has been identified as the time management guy, and by his own admission had to drop out of cooking school because he forgot to like renew yeah. his it's like, Tom, you and I are just kind of, so like we're again in the junk science that is Myers-Briggs. We are both J's. Like, we're planners, you know, we have our manifest flaws, but one of them is not, you know, lack of planning. Like, this is a dude who had to like drop out of culinary school because, forgot about the renewal. So this is a red flag.
Do you have a slept through the alarm clock story? Is it a flight that you missed?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
No, I lose everything. I am the person, where are my car keys? Oh my God, they're in my hand. I will literally at the farmer's market, I'll put like three oranges on the scale. They'll weigh them. Hey, that'll be $2. I give them my $2 and I walk away. And the vendor will come after me and say, oh, you forgot the fruit you just bought, which is the whole freaking point of the transaction. So I'm a certified space cadet.
Yeah.
But on time management, I'm pretty good. But Kenny, again, another good concept, though. Hops kombu broth, you would argue that he kind of did the infusion thing. He did a dashi. But, you know, seared, mataki, and burrata, Tom, two things I love in life. But again, Faro undercooked, that's a time issue. Danny had a more, I think Danny, by his own admission, he was a guy who knew exactly what he did wrong, right? He just kind of, the black pepper hop combo was terrible. And Joe Flam almost couldn't hide his disdain. Did it respectfully, you know, wasn't dragging him, but was just like, man, that was just intense, bro. Whatever it was that he said, but it was clear.
He goes, I wrote it down. He goes, the black pepper was wild, bro. And yeah. And Danny wasn't like, really? He was like, yeah, it was.
And look, I think it's one of those cases and you give the benefit of the doubt for a chef who's already demonstrated real skill, particularly technically in terms of flavor combos, that like Danny's probably saying to himself, I will never, ever again have to cook with frigging hops. I'm a New York chef and I do what I do. And there are certain times I think chefs where maybe you get in your own head, I'm not executing well. That was clearly an instance where, you know, Danny wasn't disrespectful of the challenge. He tried, he failed. He knows that it doesn't say anything more largely about his skills, whatever. You know, Valentine, you know, the smoke, it's always a, you know, that's one of those strategy mistakes. Like, you're going to smoke in a quick fire. Is there time to get the smoke on, especially duck, which also requires time because you got to render. You can't rush that. When you do the duck, seared duck breasts on the stovetop, I put it at medium low heat and you just let it. You just got to let, you got to wait. Ain't nothing you can do to rush that process. So again, an error of judgment in Valentine's part. He chooses a protein that requires time both for the smoking and the rendering. Neither works, and he ends up on the bottom, and which doesn't bode well for the elimination challenge.
Yeah, and the elimination challenge was a really fun one because I would like to ask you, Kevin, I don't know if you already know where I'm going with this, but should we power rank the seven different bar snacks?
Oh, yeah.
For the listeners, here's the list. Popcorn, pickles, pretzels, mixed nuts. Again, not in any order. This is not my preference. Popcorn, pickles, pretzels, mixed nuts, olives, toasted corn kernels, and potato chips.
You know what? Let's do a little draft. Let's do a little draft, a little quick mini snake draft. You go first.
All right. At number one, I'm going to take pickles.
Oh, I was debating between pickles and olives. Why pickles, Tom?
Pickles, it comes in many different flavors or different veggies. I love the sour. It's a nice contrast if you're having a dark beer or whatever. It always works. And it's not too salty, so you can go volume. And yeah, there is no salsa in chips here. And I said at the top, that's my favorite just binge food while I'm drinking. But I'm going to go pickles, and I was going to go potato chips, but I'm going to go with pickles here, number one.
Okay. I like pickles too, and so that crunch is so satisfying. Now, I'm going to make a disclaimer here. I'm taking olives number two with the understanding it's got to be some good olives.
Kalamata's preferably.
I like dried cured olives. You know, the ones that are almost feel like a gummy bear. You know, I love those. And so, but I do like Kalamata. I mean, but olives to me, again, you talk about the salt and the brine with the understanding there's a great variance in olives. There's some bad olives out there, but there's some really good olives, and really good olives are wonderful.
Pitted or not pitted?
I think pitted. As much as they're an inconvenience and you got to have this little cocktail napkin, or if they don't give you the little extra little cup, it's kind of a little awkward, or it sits on the plate and everybody's grossed out. I don't care. Olives are that good. My next one is I'm going to go with pretzels. I love the crunch. I love the salt. They're not greasy in a way that sometimes potato chips can be. I never feel gross, especially if you're eating it before the meal, which is often what you're doing at the bar. Pretzels to me have a lot of the pleasure, 80% of the pleasure of a potato chip without any 20% of the downside.
See, I'm out on pretzels. I am a salt whore. When it comes to salty food, I'm in, but then like the pretzel, for whatever reason, Kevin, I have two things that I can't do lots of salt on. One is a pretzel. I think they overdo the salt on pretzels in general. And two, the salt rimmed on the margaritas, I always opt for the no salt on the rim. For whatever, I love salty. Every time I have like a really good dish and everyone at the table is like, ooh, too salty for me, I'm like, oh, I thought that was delicious. But when it comes to those giant ice cubes or kernels of salt on your pretzels, it throws me off. But I'm with Gail. I love a good mustard. It is my favorite condiment, maybe right next to horseradish. I love that as a condiment. So I like the aspect of like a pretzel and a really spicy mustard. However, the salt throws me off. And I just kind of feel like there's a very large margin of error on a pretzel. Sometimes it's just too dry. I like a little butter glaze on a pretzel, but pretzels are down on my list. But since you took it off the board, I'm going to go potato chips and then popcorn with my next two picks.
And potato chips, do you have a variety? I mean, be more specific, please.
Cape Cod, any flavor. Right. Give me jalapeno, salt and vinegar, or just the regular one. If you have a Cape Cod bag in the vicinity, it is going to be gone within 3 seconds if I am in the room. I also won't have a roof of my mouth afterwards, which happens with Cape Cod chips. But as a New Englander myself, if there is Cape Cod in there, I will have a cheese grater going across the roof of my mouth after eating the Cape Cod. But man, those are number one in my book.
When I lived briefly in Seattle, Tim's Cascade like potato chips became my favorite. Very similar to Cape Cod. I also too am. I think salt and vinegar is far and away. Although I'll be honest, I do enjoy a very processed potato chip. Like you give me a tube of Pringles, and I'm a very happy man. And sometimes I think the fancy potato chips are not nearly as satisfying as the good old processed stuff. It's kind of like peanut butter in that way. There's certain products on the market that I just think the processed version is so far superior to the artisanal one. Yes. This leaves me with corn nuts, which were never a thing growing up for me. Like my first, like really started to understand corn nuts is when I watched the movie Heathers, the teen cult classic of We Gen Xers. Corn nuts plays a major role in Heathers. It plays almost a fatal. It's the last words of one of the murdered characters.
Hey, spoiler alert. I'm not a Gen Xer. Okay. And so I haven't seen this movie.
Are you a Heathers guy?
I've never seen this movie before. So now you've just ruined the movie for me, Kevin.
Yeah. Well, it is Winona Ryder, Christian Slater. It's Shannon Daugherty. Shannon Daugherty plays a huge role.
Oh.
It is a must watch. It was sort of a countercultural teen indie dark comedy, and it's near perfect.
Mixed nuts, though?
Yeah. Can we just be honest? And like, the only thing, like, if you give me some nice lavender almonds, like, I don't want mixed nuts. Like, the only thing I like kind of a more specific nuts, because then with the mixed nuts, first of all, what are you doing with the Brazil nut? Nobody likes a Brazil nut. Everybody hates a Brazil nut. And it's always in there.
It is the empty calorie. It is the honeydew of a fruit basket. It is a Brazil nut is awful. It's garbage. Can we all agree that the Brazil nut needs to go? It is a space filler. It is an innings eater, and it is dry. It is tasteless. And you can get rid of the Brazil nut. I can never have another Brazil nut in my life, and I will be a happy camper, Kevin. I am totally with you on this.
Yeah. Mixed nuts is the last pick. It is the Mr. Irrelevant of salty bar snacks. What they want us to do, or they want the chefs to do, is do a progressive meal. There are seven on each team. The teams are very interesting, Tom. The theme early on, and the observation is, one of the teams kind of focuses on fine dining. That would be the red team, with the Dannys and the Kevons. And then one of the teams, the yellow team, is more of a homey, sort of underdog team, at least.
Rustic is what they call it.
Rustic, yeah. That's how they perceive themselves. And the menus, there's very little rancor. I mean, there's a little kind of jockeying on who's got dessert, maybe. But Tom, this wasn't one of those rolling of the eyes around a notepad and a legal pad. Let's come up with our dishes. Why is this person being stubborn? There seems to be, both teams seem pretty simpatico.
This is maybe number two on my list of favorite kind of team aspects of Top Chef. My number one is the whole picking of teams at the schoolyard, right? Who's going to be the last pick? Who is going to be the one who feels Eeyore out there? No one likes me. That's always fun to see how they team up and stuff. That's not what this is. What I was interested in is who's the leader? Who's going to be the alpha in these like menu curating discussions? Who's going to be taking the floor and saying, no, sorry, Kevin, we're not going to do your dessert dish. I want to do that this way. It didn't seem like to me that there was any sort of delineation or any sort of hierarchy within these two groups. And by the way, just for those, a reminder for those listening, Team Red The one that was perceived to be the fine dining team was Kevin, Danny, Valentine, Laura, Amanda, Kalina, and Charlie. And what's interesting is that's basically my team. You know, Team Yellow, Rossica, Michelle, Dan, Alicia, Kenny, Savannah, and Manny. That's all your team with the exception of Michelle. So oddly enough, Kevin, we had basically facsimiles of our fantasy teams going against each other. And so there was a little bit, as I noted in my notebook here, it felt like almost my team versus your team, and Savannah making the note that like they got a lot more technical chefs. They've got more fine dining chefs. And I don't know. Would you rather have Brian Voltaggio in a head-to-head matchup against Michael Voltaggio? Because to me, I think the rustic chefs, when you're doing a bar snack challenge, I actually think they have a leg up.
I think so too, and that is how. And I think when you're talking about kind of middle brow to low brow to high brow, I'd rather start at the basics. I do think there is a tendency to over. You know, it was all, and Kevin is sort of a perfect object lesson, right? Like he comes out, he has a great showing in the quick fire. Everyone's really excited by his, he's going to do an olive trio of snacks, right? Canapes. I mean, what could be more highfalutin than canapes for a bar yeah. snack challenge, right? You got chefs over on the other side saying, oh my God, his looks so nice. Mine doesn't look very nice, right? Because, you know, Savannah's coming out of the box on Team Rustic with her, you know, melon salad. And I actually think it looks delightful, but she's intimidated because he's got this. But the problem is it was nothing but technique, right? The guy does a tempanade, a tempura, and an enchilada. You know, he does, as someone says, he does basically something olivey on a cracker of some sort. And this is where the pastry background hurts him a little bit. I mean, look, he makes a beautiful, I imagine, Tom, I could probably eat a whole bowlful, and so could you, of his Parmesan crisps. That's not the challenge, per se. Also, and Tom Colicchio, particularly curmudgeon-y this week, which I loved.
Did he like any dishes?
I don't think he liked anything on the table. But he rightly pointed out that the job of the chefs was to turn a snack into a dish, not a snack into a snack. Kevin not only turns snacks into snacks, he kind of turns one snack into three snacks. Whereas Savannah gives you a perfectly lovely pickled melon and cucumber salad with this kind of whipped cream cheese foam, a nice vinaigrette. I don't think it wowed anybody, but it was satisfying. It was a good leadoff man for a seven course tasting.
Yeah. And it's a high floor dish. You can execute that and feel like you're not going to get sent home and you're also not going to win, but you're going to move on. And that's what you want out of a leadoff batter. You just want to get on base. And so for her, Savannah, who's sadly not a part of my team, she gets on base here and Kevin just bunts right to the pitcher. Okay.
Yeah.
You gotta be able to think of the challenge in its spirit and execute. There was no creativity here. And it always goes back to, hey, never do a duo, right? A trio, I think, is better than a duo, but we know in Top Chef history, one of the big faux pas is doing a duo. And here he does a trio without any sort of inventiveness, right? It wasn't like he flipped the narrative on the olive tapenade and the cracker. They were all one note. They were all too salty. They didn't have enough acid to cut through that saltiness. And he knew it. At the judges' table, you could see that Kevin was like, yep, you're right. And it was a hard crash for Kevin, who coming off the world also, or the French Top Chef and doing a good job so far in the competition, really falls flat with his olives. But we have lots of other dishes here too to get through. But yeah, he was on the bottom three and I wasn't surprised by that.
Round two is the only round on my scorecard that I show the red team winning and not decisively. Alicia did kind of a smoked salmon rillette with, she called it an olive chimichurri. It was served on this toasted lavash that looked very difficult to eat. And again, the fatal flaw, of course, being it was a snack, not a dish. Whereas Danny, Did a salt cured salmon that wasn't sufficiently cured, apparently, but very nice. The cuts were very nice. It was a beautiful plate. You got some pickles, Tom. So your number one draft pick, I look like a, I want to say it was a pickled pearl onion, maybe some cucumber, a nice yogurt dill sauce.
Number one pick in both regards. He's got the pickle and he was my number one pick in the draft. So
there you go.
Maybe just call him one from here on out.
Yeah. And he was the only one, I think, of the red team that kind of won their head to head matchup. That's the only, on my scorecard, that is the only instance I have of the red team serving the superior dish during the concurrent serving.
I think that's fair. I think the only one who had like a really good dish was Amanda with her pretzel dessert, which we'll get to. But Danny did himself well here, but, you know, not a home run. To continue with the baseball metaphor, he had a nice little bloop single here, and he moves on without having to be in the bottom here. But yeah, the Alicia's dish didn't wow me, but I like the idea of a smoked salmon. But I'm such a sucker for sashimi salmon. I could just eat that for days. And so the idea of doing a cured salmon, big win in my book. Go for it, Danny. I love it. Keep going.
Three was Dan's popcorn mousse, my God, versus Laura's Badrigiani Nigzit eggplant rolls from Georgia. By the way, I so love that we have a chef who's going to do this sort of caucus Eastern Mediterranean food. I'm so excited about this. Unfortunately, I don't think anybody was really wowed by the eggplant rolls. The sauce was a little aggressive. And more than anything, this is at the point in the competition where Kristen, Tom, and Joe Flam noted that there's really no contour to red team's meal, right? It's not a progressive dinner. It's seven people bringing out seven dishes that don't necessarily correspond to the challenge. Nothing really ties them together. There's nothing to unify here. Whereas the yellow team at least seems like there's a cohesiveness and there's a real contour to the progression. And so that's where they note this. Dan's popcorn mousse, bizarro dish in the best way, like popcorn mousse on bottom, and then there's top with clams and some roasted corn and basil, and then a spicy popcorn kind of topping. And it was an extremely challenging. It was a really challenging day for Dan.
It was, and I had a hard time watching this episode because this Kennedy's disease hits home for me with his condition. We didn't get to see too much of his cook in the first episode. In the second episode, we got to see how debilitating this disease is for Dan. And my mother passed away from ALS this summer. And so watching him struggle to plate the dishes in time and the whole group rallying around him as he talked about his condition and his disease, which is mistaken a lot for ALS. ALS is a 100% fatal motor neuron disease that is a death sentence for between 2 to 5 years on average. And unfortunately, my mom had this disease diagnosed in 2016, and I got to see the progression of this disease and how brutal it is. You're a prisoner of your own body, and your body fails you slowly, and in many cases, quickly, and it's so sad. Rocked me when I saw Dan go through this, because what people don't realize about ALS or motor neuron diseases like Kennedy's is it takes so much energy just to do the thing that you were able to do yesterday. You wake up in the morning and suddenly it's harder to pull your socks on to your feet, way harder than the day before, or it's harder to brush your teeth than the next day in ways that it was easier the day before. So for Dan to be on Top Chef, to represent Milwaukee, and then to have to plate these meals, these dishes with less, you know, mobility, dexterity, and feeling in his hands is earth-shattering to me. And I couldn't believe, you know, how the rest of his teammates picked him up. But it was gut-wrenching to watch because I just know firsthand how difficult that is, the mental anguish of going into a competition and trying to do something that maybe a week ago you could do, and then facing these real physical and mental hurdles. You're exhausted, Kevin. You're fighting your own body, and it's just the physical and mental fatigue that you have to face, and just the emotional, I gotta be 10 times better than the next person because I'm dealing with a condition that really puts me at a disadvantage here. And watching this, it really felt like Dan is, what a human being and what a courageous person to not just deal with this disease, but also enter yourself into a Top Chef competition at this stage of your progression. So this hits close to home, and I'll get off my soapbox here, but I will say, Kevin, this was important to talk about. And I know people, if they want to help out, it's Kennedy's disease. Dan's got many initiatives to, if you want to support at home, please do that. Dan is, what a warrior to be dealing with this on Top Chef. And I gotta say, this is a tricky thing. You're trying to win every competition. It was cool to see the team rally around him and help him finish this dish, because it was a knockout dish for sure.
Yeah, I mean, again, the physical demands, and it's something we talk about both offline and online with the chefs. It's just like, this is a really physically demanding show. And so Dan's, I hope we can follow him for a while here in the competition. It was incredible to watch. It was a really nice moment in back in the holding tank when he addressed it.
The stew room. We got the stew room back. It's good to see.
Yeah, speaking of the spoon room, Manny steps up again. He has mixed nuts and says, I'm going to do a guajiro and mixed nuts mole with chicken. And it is kind of the first dish that really, really wows the chefs, right? They I think they were completely underwhelmed in the first kind of the first six dishes come out. Not completely underwhelmed. I mean, actually, a dance dish was really well received. But like, there was just nothing, you know, but Manny's was sort of the first dish that just kind of got Kristen excited. He is, you know, there's real Gregory Gourdet, I think, to his cooking. Chef Evelyn, I was thinking about in terms of Houston. There is a, hey, chicken and mole. There's not a lot of extra fuss, but you don't sacrifice flavor. I would never call it minimalist either, right? Like, he's got this Top Chef type game. Like, there's a certain kind of, there's a certain approach, I think, to cooking that Top Chef rewards. And we saw it with Evelyn. We saw it with Gregory. And I think we're seeing it with Manny. So he had the first real banger. We forgot Michelle's crab biscuit. That's what happened. Michelle was against Laura. So we have a toasted corn kernel and crab biscuit with spicy High Life honey.
Yeah.
And that was the matchup against the Georgian eggplant rolls. And Michelle clearly had a lot of fans with that High Life honey.
Yeah, and I'm surprised she didn't get in the top three here. Maybe the Colicchio's critique, the fact that where's the crab? Maybe there just wasn't enough crab here. Another thing here, Kevin, that I was wondering, how much did the chefs get to watch them eat? Because there were a couple like commentaries of chefs going back being like, oh, they ate every bite of that, or they said it was so good. But we didn't get to see them linger. And I'm wondering, Kevin, did you get a sense like, did they watch them eat the whole meal or half the meal? Because they did get some kind of responses to go back into the kitchen in the stew room.
I don't know, because those caves were really narrow. The Miller caves that have been around for more than a century. And I did not, you know, it would have made sense in week one when they had that sort of open Roman Colosseum situation. But I was kind of surprised as well that they were kind of just either lurking or the chefs felt completely okay tipping their hand while the judges, while the chefs were standing there.
Yeah, and it was, I thought Michelle's dish, even though, you know, Tom was critical of the amount of crab on it, I thought that was a strong dish for her, and I'm surprised it wasn't in the top. But yeah, the thing about Laura's is that probably doesn't get a critique if it's the main event. Like, if it's the main event before the dessert, I don't think people are going to be as critical as it was. It just wasn't a good sequencing for Team Red.
I got us out of order there. Let's go to Valentine's dish, which was the losing dish of the day. He drew toasted corn kernels, right? Which are really corn nuts, and I imagine they just couldn't use the corn nut TM trademark. But that's what they were talking about. That was my sense, is toasted corn kernels are corn nuts, right? But corn nuts is a official probably licensed or
brand, yeah,
trademark brand, right? So he does a beer and corn soup, which everyone else at the table rendered a sauce. They, in their minds, that was a sauce with some Fresno chilies, some chili oil, some chives. It was, again, they did not regard it as a soup. Number two, there is a difference between, as Gail said, between a corn, toasted corn kernel and corn. They are two different things. And they docked him for honestly just using the toasted corn kernels as a garnish, usually just kind of piggybacking off the corn and toasted corn kernels and turning that into a corn soup. It's not the same thing. Gail wanted something toasted. I think it seemed to eat really rich. Nobody liked it.
Yeah. And you know what, Kevin? Big red flag that Valentine was like, I tasted my soup and I'm going to tell you, delicious. And then he gets sent home. If you can't even get in the same ballpark of what the judges are going to say, it seems like you don't have a long track record here on Top Chef. So I was writing in my notes, oh, he loves his dish. It looks good. Soup seems to be like a high floor scenario. He's not getting sent home. And then they hated it because it was too thick. And I was totally stunned by that. I thought, given his confidence in his dish, there was no way he was going to get sent home. We'll talk about that later. And it was a real disappointing performance from Valentine. From the quick fire to this, it just didn't land either one.
The other chef, counter to Manny, who did sort of the big protein on a plate, kind of a composed entree, was Charlie, who did a potato chip crusted Spanish mackerel, which kind of sounds wonderful, black bean puree and beurre blanc. And I think by all accounts, had he executed the cook, I think the judges would have liked it. Unfortunately, they found both the kind of the elements on the plate to be underseasoned. And in a couple of cases, it looked like the Spanish mackerel was just underdone. And in that's not a dish where you want the big sashimi, the big block of sashimi middle on the fish. You want to cook that gently, but you want to cook it. And so, you know, I think Charlie was pretty stung because, again, I mean, whether he prides himself on kind of being a good chef that does season, as he says, hey, I make black beans every day, to have the puree be told it was bland is just, I mean, bland is just one of those words where, wow. I mean, I don't know what your words are as a writer, Tom, where the worst possible adjective to describe your work would just crush you. But I think it's fair to say that in the kitchen, if you're a professional chef, to have your food called bland is just really rough. And Charlie, I think, was stung by it. He just didn't execute the dish.
Charlie should have gone home.
Oh, interesting.
Should have gone home. You failed the protein, right? You got to nail the protein, didn't nail the protein. Undercooked, wasn't consistent throughout. Secondly, you had a bland black bean sauce. Those two things normally get you sent home. I had him going home on this, you know, between him, Kevin, we'll talk about in a little bit. I thought this was a deal breaker. You can't miss your protein and have a bland black bean sauce. Those two things usually get you kicked to the curb. So I thought Charlie was going to be sent, pack your knives and go. And he stayed on. And I know Valentine didn't have a great dish. Maybe it was because he didn't have a protein to not nail, right? To me, Charlie was, he was the one on the chopping block.
You're right. Two kind of fatal failures. Boy, that soup must have been really terrible. Yeah. This is my only reaction. Like, all right, I love, you know, to me, the most interesting stuff happened at the end of this competition. First, you have Kenny in a moment of redemption, a potato chip pavé with a beef gravy and a togarashi yogurt. It apparently tasted like sour cream and onion potato chips. And Tom, I love sour cream, onion, and potato chips. That's one of my, right behind salt and vinegar is.
Oh, I thought it was French onion.
But you know what I mean? Like that onion, like an onion flavored potato chip, right? Like, French onion rather, sorry. But like an onion flavored potato chip is delicious. It was a wonderful moment of redemption. He did not run up into any time constraints. Perhaps this is a good sort of lesson for him in the sense that, hey, why don't you choose scenarios where time becomes less of a variable, but he gets mentioned on the top. He's one of the top three chefs of the day in the elimination challenge for that. It just, also just kind of looked delicious. I mean, it just kind of really savory, yummy, perfect amount of fat kind of bar food.
Is there anything better than French onion dip or French onion soup? I have a real soft spot for anytime that's on a menu. I had it at Disney World a couple weeks ago at the Beast's like French Chateau in the middle of Disney World in Orlando, and they had French onion soup on the menu, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna eat that. And it was so decadent and delicious. Anytime you have that flavor profile, it's a winner in my book. So Kenny, shouts to you for doing that and executing. Also very high on my, like, when I'm had a few beers in me, if you have any sort of French onion and Fritos nearby, it's done. So yeah, Kenny, well done by him. And Manny, here's my only thing about Manny, okay? Manny with the mole, did he bring it out too soon, okay? Because we saw Gabri last year ride the moles all the way through. When you have immunity, I thought he might have busted out the mole a little too soon, where it's not going to win you anything because you already got immunity. I might have thought you would break out the mole later, but he can go back to that well like Gabri did last year. I just worry he might be like, you know, I did mole on that second episode. Maybe I'll go in a different direction.
No, Tom, but there are many varieties of mole. There's mole negro and mole verde and mole amarillo.
It is not Top Chef. It is Top Mole. And why not? Because mole is delicious. I predict you are correct. He did bring it out very soon, and there will be other moles. You can always do more mole, and there are many types and varieties of mole.
I know. I'm just trying to tear him down because he's not on my team, and you won last year, so you got the number one pick. So I'm just trying to find reasons to tear down the GOAT right now in this season. Manny finishes in the top three in this after winning the first challenge. Kevin, you got to be really happy about Rosica here, who... came out of the middle of the pack in our draft and really showed out in this episode.
She's going to do something crazy. She's going to do pretzel barley cake with a pretzel granita over that and then topped with what? A honey mustard sabayon? Are you kidding me? What a weirdo dish. Everyone thinks it's a weirdo dish. But Tom, there is one question that determines success on Top Chef. And I'm talking about top level success, Tom. And that question is, can you execute risk? That's it. That's the game. Can you execute risk? You can skate for a little while with reliable dishes. Oh, you took a classic and just refined it, right? Yeah, that's great. You'll end up on the judges' table a couple times. That's fine. But can you execute risk is the heuristic you should use if you want to determine whether someone has what it takes to be Top Chef. Rosica showed that. And by the way, the suspense. The pretzel granita isn't setting in the freezer. It's not even cold. So she goes to liquid nitrogen, which she's used never before. And yeah. Liquid nitrogen, you know, better living through chemistry. Lo and behold, it freezes. And she does it, right? Like, everyone is wowed. I love what Tom Colicchio said. This is not a dish that would ever come out of someone's brain unless you drop them into a crazy challenge like this. But can you execute risk? The answer is yes, she does. I also want to give a quick shout out, though, to Amanda for her beer and pretzel pre-dessert. Tom's grousing that he hates when you go to a tasting menu and you get like two desserts and that first one's kind of a palate cleanser. Bah. In his good grace, he did admit that, you know what, it tasted pretty good, her beer and lime granita pretzel beer foam miso thing, that it actually was perfect in a beer challenge in Milwaukee in the Miller Cave. I thought that was cool, too. But Tom, Rosica, yeah, I just executed risk.
All right, executed risk, and usually when you see the liquid nitrogen or the pressure cooker popping out where people are like, I have never done this before, it's usually a disaster. And so she executed the risk. It was a big red flag that she had never done liquid nitrogen before, and she was, you know, not a top performer in the first episode, and on this one, she showed through. And Amanda, that looked like vom. It looked terrible.
It looked bad.
It looked terrible, and if she didn't have just an amazing flavor profile on that dish, I was nervous as hell watching this one with Amanda, because I know she can do this. I know she can win this Top Chef competition. But when you're looking at that dish, Kevin, it did not look appetizing. And you hear Tom already hating on it before it even hits the plate, talking about you can't do two desserts here. And she knocked it out of the park. So Amanda, nice job there. And yes, Gail, I love a good mustard. I am a big fan of mustard. And the fact that they were able to nail this dish, each of them, using the pretzel, which is on lower on my power rankings than you have, Kevin. Really showed out. Impressive work from both of these two chefs.
Yeah, and Kalina had a nice dessert. Didn't apparently, just from a chemical standpoint, execute the budino perfectly. It might have been a little overcooked. It wasn't a perfect budino. But, you know, hey, I'll never do. I love a salty caramel dessert. I'm a fan of that. So, mm-hmm. You know, among the red team people, she did fairly well. And it was ultimately a rough day for the red team. Tom, I mean, closing thoughts. I mean, just pulling it all together. What did we learn? What did you learn?
We learned that the chef's table drafters are very good at their jobs. You have quite the boardroom there. You had 27 points, Team Kevin. You had 10 from Rossica. You had 5 from Kenny and another 5 from Manny. You know, Charlie was the only dud on this, on your team this year. I had a lot of losers here, not too excited about where things are starting off. I had 9 points, you had 27. I thought Charlie should have gone home. I really did, and I actually had Valentine as the safest of the bottom 3. I thought Kevin, even though he understood that, you know, he deserved to be in the bottom 3, I thought maybe he was going to go home. I thought Charlie was a no-brainer, that he was going to pack his knives and go. But he hangs on to the competition, stays on your squad. I thought Joe Flam did an excellent job here. Wasn't a huge fan of the comedian. Thought it was weird to have the comedian at the table amongst a bunch of food connoisseurs, just to spice it up a little bit. I don't know. What was your take?
My take is he's this very particular species of Milwaukee bro. And that's okay.
Yeah.
Like, not for you, not for me.
Yeah.
I gave us a Milwaukee bro. I kind of actually appreciated the sort of man on the street, layperson shtick that was going on. It wasn't insufferable to me. It's not necessarily my cup of tea, but I was kind of all right with it. I really was. By the way, Tom, in closing, next week we will be back on Last Chance Kitchen duty. And there is, and we'll talk more about it next week. Apparently there is a 16th mystery chef. Who's not such a mystery anymore, a Chicago-based chef who's going to be joining the competition as sort of like a first four NCAA tournament, like only plays, has to play in Last Chance Kitchen, come up through there. But they are introducing that wrinkle. Should be really interesting.
Yeah, and we're glad that Top Chef Last Chance Kitchen's back. LCK is back, so we don't have to worry about that. And Murphy's gone. I think Valentine's going to go against our new guy here. So I think Murphy, our instincts were correct that he was actually going home back to his family. So Valentine, I'm rooting for you to come back into this competition and win. I think you have more to show, and we'll see it next episode. And coming up, we're going to have an interview with Joe Flam in the next episode. So stay tuned for that as we go on with our new Pack Your Knives Substack season, which you can find at packyourknives.com. And of course, sign up to be a paid subscriber or a Chef's Table subscriber, packyourknives.com. Tell your friends, more the merrier. And thanks for all the support.
For Tom Haverstroh and for producer Anthony Mays, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.